Hello and welcome to the Extronics Hazardous Area IoT podcast. My name is Stuart Milne and I'll be your host for the podcast. Today I'm joined by CEO of Extronics, John Hartley. I'm also joined by Chris Sadler, BDM for the Americas for Extronics, and our expert guest today, James Crowder, IT consultant and network infrastructure and architect specialist for Interpret Flow. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello, Stuart.
Welcome.
Yeah, hi.
Hey, Stuart.
On today's podcast, we're going to be talking about how to plan for a successful hazardous area wireless deployment, what to look out for, some of the key considerations, and the benefits of working with specialists. But before we get into that, James, I wonder if you could just give our listeners a little bit of insight into your background.
Well, I basically come from a several years of working in IT, kind of from the ground up. I started in electronic repair and design and engineering, and migrated over to networking because I saw it as one big circuit. So I've been fortunate in my career to have worked in manufacturing and banking and healthcare, utilities. I haven't jumped around a lot. Have always really mostly been a consumer. So once I moved into the consulting world, I still maintain that consumer perspective, right? The owner of the technology. And it allows me to really integrate well with a customer because at the end of the day, it's all about ownership.
That's great. Thanks very much for introducing yourself there, James. Chris, if I could come to you first, please could you set the scene here by explaining a bit about the process industry landscape and why wireless technology is such an important part of the digitalization roadmap for many businesses?
Hi, Stuart. Thanks for that question. Yeah, it's good to be here on this podcast. So if we look at digitization in our industry, the process industry, it covers a fairly wide remit, and wireless empowerment of unlocking the sort of trapped data on your plant is very important, all the way from things right at the top end, from sort of digital twin type information, condition monitoring systems, all the way to sort of bog standard connectivity, if you like. And wireless is important because it can help the end user operator avoid the traditional systems that are there in our industry, like the process control system or the shutdown system. Of course, those are systems that have inputs and outputs, but to add or remove those inputs or outputs would be a year-long project rather. So wireless can empower you to do something more quickly, direct to cloud, avoid legacy systems on site. And then, of course, there's the massive march of all the end devices, client devices that are wirelessly enabled now, phones, tablets, headsets with cameras and tablets built into them. So it's all about how you can gather that trapped data on site, really, from some very kind of large aspects, digital twin, all the way through to basic connectivity and replacing pen and paper. And that's part of everyone's sort of digitization sort of march at the moment.
I think it's worth adding, actually, though, things about like tracking where your assets are, worker safety, enhanced security on facilities, using real-time location systems sort of are all in the mix of digitalization and driving those efficiency and process improvements.
Yeah, one of the neat things about my career and having spanned such a long time is I've watched these transitions, right? We call it the digitalization roadmap and so forth. So a lot of these aspects, right, telemetry gathering, right, getting your key performance indicators and whatnot, have been part of enterprise business for a long, long time. Utilizing wireless, utilizing different sensor data, different customer data, different process data, and so forth has been there. The challenge in the industrial side has always been the expense and the lack of devices that support it, which have now turned a page. And I think that's why that is a new aspect or growing aspect in business in that digital processing side, because these tools are now readily available. They're ready for deployment. They're ready to go into these environments. They're ready to replace the clipboards that have been the cornerstone. And it's industry's turning a page, and it's driven to because this data, it's gold. It's extremely valuable.
James, going back to the question about wireless, if you think that all the various wireless technologies that are out there, all their standards are now very up to date.
Yep.
And have enhanced tremendously over the last 5 years. Wi-Fi is very powerful now. with Wi-Fi 6 coming out. It's almost like an LTE solution. We've got the license bands being given here in the US by the FCC, the CBRS private LTE system. We've got LoRaWAN, all those standards developing, and other radio technologies. So all giving us more bandwidth, more access to the airwaves for sort of slow moving, low, small bits of data, or very high bandwidth pieces of data, as in Wi-Fi 6, which, you know, if you want to do a video link out on site, you're going to need those high bandwidth kind of wireless systems.
Drone controls, right? You've got the wireless for drone controlling now. You've got the ISA 100 for the meshing of various sensory data devices. I mean, there's a plethora of technology that's out there and available for deployment. So it has to be on the roadmap for companies. They're leveraging this to be profitable.
That's really interesting. And James, I'm going to stick with you here because I want to jump into some of the challenges that customers must consider when planning to install a wireless network. I wonder if you could talk around that.
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the things being down here at the Gulf Coast is, you know, we have hurricanes, you know, and it really shows you that there's a massive environmental challenge, right? And for these facilities that are mission critical, you know, you don't just turn a nuclear reactor off because the weather got stormy. So you have to take that into account where you're deploying. Are there limitations where you have to have, you know, concrete pole or pole sunk in concrete 12 feet just to put an access point up? Do you have infrastructure such as power out there? Do you have to use multiple radio technologies in order to build a mesh? Are you in an explosive area or a likely to be explosive area? High dust contaminant, high moisture, high temperature. Are you in a coking facility, an acid facility, like an alky facility at a processing plant? You know, there's a tremendous amount of things that you have to account for. Radiation zones. Are you dealing with an open air outdoor area, or are you dealing with enclosed areas? Control rooms, heating and air conditioning. I mean, it is a major challenge for an infrastructure architect to determine, can he put this piece of equipment within this environment? What special rules, special codes, special items? So there's a tremendous amount of risk and liability, right? A tremendous amount of expense. If you do a wireless design and put access points in places they're not efficient, it can cost $25,000, $50,000, $100,000 to move that AP. It's considerably different from when you look at an office infrastructure and you just grab a ladder, move an AP over a few tiles, and then call it done, right? The chance for going back and retuning or readjusting is very slim, and it's very costly.
I mean, if you look at classified areas or hazardous locations out on various process plants, clearly the smart money is to deploy your radio in the safe area if that's possible. But more and more now, it's not possible because of the sort of small cells or pico cells, greater areas to cover, penetration right into the unit. So that and we're seeing that massive kind of growth, if you like.
Oh yeah, you can't hand someone a video headset, right, for three-dimensional virtual reality, have them going out to take pictures of pipelines and valves and things and transmit that data back when they round the corner behind a tank and suddenly they can't be seen anymore, right? This data needs to be real time. It has to be uploaded. It's dependent on other systems.
Yeah, and we're seeing that especially offshore, where a vessel will be blanket kind of zoned, zone one or division one. We've seen that in the chemical industry where they have much smaller batch processes, small rooms. So you get a lot of small zones there, division one.
Facilities that are made out of steel.
And those are areas where you have to place your wireless equipment to get that coverage.
Yeah, and the last thing I'd probably add to that really is especially in these environments we just mentioned about being by the coast, you know, saline atmospheres, offshore platforms and things like that. Also in chemical plants, etc. You do need to choose the materials of construction of your equipment well, because they'll suffer from corrosion, which will ultimately affect the performance, making sure the right level of ingress protection's there and things like that. All really important to ensure very reliable installation once it's been deployed.
Okay, especially when you start talking about life safety systems, right? I mean, you have to look at positive air, nitrogen atmosphere, you know, within enclosures. you know, and these are, it's not just the challenge of the install, right? It's not just the survey and making sure, it's telling the business that this investment is going to provide this return, right? Because without the return on that investment, the business is going to look at it and say, well, this is just a, you know, really expensive, you know, Wi-Fi infrastructure. What are we really going to get for value out of it? So, you know, as the architect or as the designer, that's part of the story. It's not just telling you, yeah, I can put an access point over here or an LTE cell over here. It's a matter of allowing the business to see what that value is, right? What are they going to get at the end of the day? Because the technology, it's just a tool, right? But it is extremely challenging with a tremendous amount of other factors. You know, exactly what you said, John, you know, but yeah, getting that data and knowing what to do with that data is the key.
It's the key to getting a return on your investment for sure.
Yep.
That's really insightful. And sort of taking that a step further, James, could you expand on that by telling us what are some of the most important steps required by a customer to fully understand their environments? We've talked about the challenges, but how do they go about understanding that?
It really comes down to obtaining the data for the facilities directly, right? Looking at network surveys, which is beyond just network survey, right? You're actually surveying the environment, right? Looking at all of the attributes, taking into account what those installation challenges are, what those costs would be, right? And then looking at wrapping the technology around that. You know, how will the wireless perform? What is the expectation of the wireless that the customer has? Are they okay with low data rate, message-based, you know, delivery because it's an RTLS platform, they don't need a lot? Or are they looking at high-end video, doing X-ray transmissions, right, or transmitting X-ray data for tanks or valves, things of that nature? All of those items have to be looked at when you're doing a survey. And interviews with the people that are out there, what are their conditions, right? How do they conduct their day? Are they able to carry laptops? Are they able to carry pads? Are they able to carry smartphones? What areas do they carry them within? I mean, it's great to do, as Chris was talking about, a perimeter infrastructure in order to lower costs. But if you hand a guy a device that's not designed to go into an explosive area, well, he has to leave that at the door. And there's no data to be collected now. So all of this has to come into a cohesive design. So the survey itself, network survey, customer survey is critical to laying out what that infrastructure is going to look like and ultimately deliver.
I hear that a lot, James. I hear that a lot from some of the clients that I deal with. They say, oh, the LTE providers told me I've got 100% coverage here, but we know when we walk into the unit with our phones, we lose connection. And I often ask them, well, did that particular business do a radio survey for you? And the answer is always no.
No, the upfront costs are usually not, you know, the customers don't get excited about upfront costs, right? Spending the money to determine what can actually be done. It's, you know, much easier for a lot of the technology vendors to say, oh, yeah, no, we got coverage, or, oh, no, yeah, it'll be flawless. You know, oh, we're relying on the latest, you know, protocols and whatnot, and it'll be great. And they build a sense of confidence that at the end is highly expensive to support because you have so many unknowns. So you have to go into it eyes wide open. You have to obtain that data.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what you're highlighting there is predictive type surveys and stuff, yeah,
yes,
are brilliant in predictable facilities. And certainly open air, great wide open spaces are probably one of the most predictable. But when you throw in a big heavy metallic processing unit of 400 meters, 200 meters or something like that, a mass of steel, yeah, those predictive tools don't always accurately map out the radio propagation. Yeah.
Well, some of the fun ones that we have are like the shipping container yards, right, or the tank container yards. And those change their layouts on a regular, depending upon the season. Is it the oil season? Is it the plastic season? Is it the, you know, whatever the chemistry is, they change the yard layouts. And that can dramatically affect your coverage model. You go out one moment and you survey and you do, you know, lay all the things out. And then suddenly you come back and the customer's upset because it doesn't work. And the yards changed. You have to know to ask those questions. Hey, guys, do you have a static layout or does this change? Cranes that move within facilities, metal storage, metal manufacturing. You know, you go into a warehouse and there's no rolls of steel, or they're only 6 feet high. You come back later and they've put, you know, bins in that stack them 20 feet high. So all of those are dynamics you have to ask, talk about, and interview for.
Would you say that a survey is such a valuable piece in the, in this whole picture? Just because I've often seen, I don't know another word, carpet bombing of radio gateways across a facility. Just ridiculous amounts. It doesn't happen often, but in order to, for the provider to sort of, well, we've guaranteed your coverage. So do you feel that there's savings there? Just if you just do that survey work first and understand your environment, you can save a tremendous amount.
When you start talking about carpet bombing, right, where you go in and say, well, I'm just gonna, you know, put a radio every 30 feet, you know, you can have too much RF. There's only so much, you know, airwave that you can put out there until you start being counterproductive. And what we find for customers that have done that, they end up turning off 50% of their radios because it turns out they can't use them. It's too much saturation. There's not enough airtime, not enough availability, not enough frequency, too much interference, you know, co-channel interference between the devices. And so they end up spending all this money to deploy within these environments to go in and literally render it inept, useless,
right?
So those are things, you know, that in that upfront investment, that's why one of the focuses we have several tools that we've built, things that we deploy within these environments, right? Broadcasting radios, multicast radios, in order to create and build that environment to read that data, to get it to be predictive and very accurate. It's a critical step that is often overlooked because it's an expensive step. But in the end, it's a savings. It's a cost savings because you know what you need, right, in order to deliver to that expectation.
And James, just jumping in on that point there, it kind of leads on to the next question I had quite nicely about the equipment required to carry out these surveys, and does it change depending on the environment you're in and that you may be entering into? I wonder if you could talk around that point.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mentioned earlier about the acid or the alky facilities, the coking facilities. Is it an explosive area? Is it a nuclear area? Those are the ones I love because they tell you you might not get your equipment back if it's become irradiated. Each of those environments requires a different type of technology. In a lot of cases, we have to have self-sealed units that are hazardous, certified, that we can place in these areas to broadcast radio. We have clients that we put on tripods that we scatter around the unit in order to look at things from a client perspective. Like, let's say it's RTLS, right, where the access point's not important, the client's important. There's a large cache that we maintain of specialty devices for each of these areas. There's no one size fits all, right? We utilize tools, some of the tools that are out there that are off the shelf. We've made modifications and taken them places they never expected to go in order to obtain telemetry, right? The data we talk about, so that we can predict what the environment is going to do, what it's capable of, and then how do we approach it cost effectively to meet the customer's expectations.
Yeah, I think you know, carrying out the survey with that type of equipment you touched upon, it might need to be hazardous area rated, for instance. And we have built as a company over the years sort of hazardous area zone one surveying kits. Mm-hmm. They are expensive though and more cumbersome just due to the construction and the weight and things like that. So generally speaking, what we find, especially if it was, say, a refinery in areas like that, where they're just generally a zone two or a division two hazardous area, so only hazardous in an abnormal operation, you tend to use more standard surveying tools with a hot work permit, taking a gas detector around. That allows you to often use your standard surveying kits rather than specially built one.
Well, we get away with four gas detectors, right, mounted as part of the equipment, and we get hot permits or hot work permits. I mean, there are ways to navigate it depending upon the facility and what the requirements are. But again, each survey is custom tailored to what that facility is, the customer's tolerances, right? And so there's, you know, almost I can say that there's no two that are ever the same. And again, it also depends. Are we talking about a location tracking? Are we talking about an LTE, private LTE? Are we talking about a traditional wireless? You know, even the technology for that end delivered business goal is going to dictate what that survey looks like. Can we utilize perimeter devices or do we utilize client devices? All of that is tailor set.
Quick question, because I often get this. Someone will come to me with a load of heat maps. So they'll say, you know, look, my provider has given me all the heat maps for these, taking, say, Wi-Fi. Are those useful in survey work or not? People seem to think
they're useful to. They're useful to a degree. Now, I have a kind of a unique opinion on it because I look at a lot of the different data. Most heat maps are predictive in themselves, right? They take two or three points of key data, and then they kind of extrapolate and simulate what that would look like, and they kind of fill in the colors. That's good, but it's also bad because it doesn't always take in to account the structure, the facility, or the changes within the facility. We try to program in attenuation, put in walls or objects, things of that nature. But again, you have to look and say, all right, I know I need to go obtain data from here, from there, and so forth. So heat maps, I always take with a grain of salt, right? It depends on knowing where the data points are and so forth. Is it useful? Yes. But it also depends on, are you doing a client-based or a provider-based, meaning are you looking at the heat map from an AP perspective, right? Or are you looking at a heat map from how the client sees the environment?
Sometimes, though, you have no choice but to do it predictively or based on experience, because if it's a new offshore platform, for instance, mm-hmm. or FPSO or something like that, all you have is a set of drawings and 3D models and things. And really, you've got to do that from experience as well counts, you know, understanding, because you have deployed this stuff before from a similar plant that's been done successfully, transplant that approach by looking at the environment and understanding how it's going to operate, the multipath effects maybe, or this, that, and the other. I think
right. My team calls that modeling. So what we do is we have a library that we apply to our tools, right, and to some of the tools that we've built, and we do modeling. We know what the radio looks like, right, at, let's say, a processing facility, right, that has a large furnace or something, right, and we know what that radio would look like around that facility. So we utilize that data to model what it would look like at a new facility, right? A brand new, let's say, liquefied natural gas facility, right? An LNG facility. We can tell you what the data is, you know, what the expected predicted placement is going to look like around a compressor that's inside of a housing, right? And so we utilize that to come up with a better predictive model. Mm-hmm. So it sometimes it's a little more than, you know, well, a lot of the times it's more than just putting an AP, and you know, X never marks the spot. Especially when you start talking about reflective radio performance, as you said, the multipath and whatnot, leveraging those protocols and their benefits, but knowing how to predict how those protocols are going to react.
Brilliant. And when we talk about planning a wireless network, we often discuss the different requirements for outdoor environments versus indoor areas. And I guess this follows on from the points you were just making there, James, but maybe you could give me an example here of the different types of adjustments that need to be made to achieve the required connectivity results in an outdoor processing environment.
Well, so outside, obviously, environment's going to be key, right? What are your restrictions for placing devices, power, things of that nature? Then, of course, your application's going to make a huge difference as well. RTLS is going to need specific design strategies over, let's say, just your a typical, you know, personal computer device. So we have to take and look at that. AP placement becomes critical, leveraging the outdoor facility where there's buildings, where there's structures, utilizing those as buffering points at times. All that has to be taken into account and specific to an application, right? There's no real one size fits all. It just, you know, it depends on what those expectations are again. Cost is a big factor. That, you know, it may be a situation where you talk to the customer about reducing the footprint of coverage due to the high cost of trying to put coverage in these areas. So outdoor versus indoor. Indoor becomes, you know, much easier to control because you're dealing with an inside environment. Now, maybe it's a highly dusty environment. Maybe it's a paint style environment or a coating environment. You know, and you have to take that into account. But installation is typically a little more straightforward because you have a facility around you. And then, of course, you've got walls within the facility and equipment that you have to account for and so forth. So it's a different strategy. And then you have the hybrids, right? You have open air structures with outdoor open space, you know, like the lay down yards and things of that nature that might be right next to an open platform or a multi-story platform. And that has to be taken into account. How will my outdoor uncovered radios affect my covered partially indoor deployment? So it's, again, it becomes very unique, you know, but that's the point of the survey. It's not just about how well the radio performs. It's about learning the facility, knowing its tells, if you will, or discovering its tells.
Chris, moving that on a little bit and coming to you next. Wi-Fi has traditionally been the go-to technology for the process industries. What other technologies are now starting to gain ground, particularly with hazardous area applications?
Yeah, this is a really interesting one, and it's developed quite quickly in the last few years. And you're right, so Wi-Fi was our bread and butter work for many years, for example, as those various Wi-Fi vendors didn't have a certified product that could go in these areas. Some of that they do now, but we still kind of work around the gaps, and a lot of it's to do with actually the latest and greatest. So, you know, Wi-Fi manufacturer would bring out a Wi-Fi 4 or Wi-Fi 5 device fully certified for, say, Division 2. But of course, everybody wants Wi-Fi 6. So, and they don't have, but you know, so that kind of, there's that kind of march still going on. But more interestingly, recently, talking about other devices, we've seen a big upsurge in interest in CBRS here in the US. So this is the new frequency allocated state by state for a small private LTE system. And these systems, I'm not an expert, but they have much smaller kind of coverage, shorter range, and they need lots of these little cells. So we're doing a lot of work with these manufacturers for indoor installations and trying to do some more outdoor installations. And it's all about, they have to place these small Pico cells closer to the units or closer to the sort of Connex boxes. So that's definitely a big increase. The other side we're seeing quite rapidly is all the condition monitoring market. So a lot of small, low-cost, Hazlot rated devices coming onto the market for, you know, temperature, condition, vibration. And these are using technologies sort of Bluetooth low energy to communicate fairly large amounts of data, I guess, in some respects, to a gateway. So we're working with a lot of BLE gateway manufacturers that just have great industrial standard product, but of course it's not Hazlot rated. So we work with them to deploy those gateways into Division 2 or sometimes Division 1, Zone 1, Zone 2, if you're over in Europe. That's a big part of our business now, actually. That's coming on. Like our work with Cassia, you'll see that, the Cassia X2000 gateway. That's a great gateway and can have 40 simultaneous BLE tethered connections. And that's all to do with condition monitoring systems predominantly. And then other things, we mentioned RTLS a few times in this podcast. So other RTLS technologies like ultra wideband, they all need their receivers located in the hazardous areas, and you need lots of them, especially for that technology. So we're working with those businesses to help them deploy those receivers in those areas. And then coming back to good old Wi-Fi and the amount of client devices. So if a company's not got a Wi-Fi strategy, but their workforce want to use a headset with a camera in it, not mentioning any brands, but they're only on the Wi-Fi frequency. So things like Wi-Fi to LTE routers, we work with a number of manufacturers of those industrial devices to deploy those in the hazardous areas. You can create a kind of a hotspot to attach your clients to, and then you're straight up into the cloud. So it's a real mix, and it's grown rapidly in the last 5 years.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, just adding to that, Chris, LoRaWAN, I think, is one that's really started to gain in popularity just in the last 2 years. You know, I mean, the technology's been around for many years, longer than that, but it's considered a mature technology now, much like all the others that you've mentioned. You know, Wi-Fi has been around since, you know, 2004 or whatever. And then these have come out sort of in the last decade, but they are considered mature technologies now, so ready for deployment into the harsh, hazardous process industrial environments. And Laura Wan, I'm hearing now, talking to lots of different oil and gas and chemical customers, pretty much we are going to deploy LoRa WAN. It is happening, yeah? And looking at it, because LoRa WAN is such a long-range technology, in open space, certainly 10 kilometres is feasible. But when you start looking at it, and yes, I can cover my site. I was talking to a couple of customers recently. I've covered my complete refinery with four gateways mounted in a safe area. And I then go, are you really there? When it sort of touches a little what Jane said earlier, there and yourself, Chris, there are spots, there are lots of RF shadow areas. So, and the other thing to really take on board with LoRa WAN is the reason they get more range is by adjusting what they call the spreading factor. And this really means if you're pushing it to the limits, yeah, you might be able to connect to that sensor quite a long way away. But the problem is that sensor is on air many, many times longer than if you had a few extra gateways installed in the hazardous area in the process plant. And the benefit of that is the sensor is battery powered, so you don't have to change the batteries 5 or 10 times more often than you do with the sparse network. And again, these sort of things come into play. So yeah, maybe at the beginning, install a few gateways to have a play around because it's really cheap, put it in your safe area. But once you start getting into scaling up these networks, you then have to look at many other things like resiliency, you know, reliability and all that sort of stuff. And that's why we're seeing, even with these long range technologies, where you can, in theory, put them in a safe area off the hazardous area plant, you still do need hazardous area versions to do it properly.
Yeah. And John, you know, one of the things that I've got, there's no free lunch, right? We've all heard that around for a long time. And that's something that we have to take into account, you know, the designers, the consultants of this, you know, the backhaul has always been a problem, right? Getting a gateway, getting something into an area and then backhauling that data, whether it's a wireless mesh, whether it's an Ethernet, right? There's some type of mechanism. And yeah, LoRaWAN, fantastic technology, the BLE, the ultra wideband, all of these things are fantastic, but there's always a magic trade-off, right? Everybody wants one gateway at the top of a tower to cover 1,000 square miles, but then you run into air availability, right? The devices, how long they have to air check and retransmit. That consumes electricity, you know, consumes battery. You know, we talk about BLE being, you know, a great battery life and whatnot. But in certain deployments, that battery life can be diminished because of these other items for the protocols to survive. Message size is a huge one. LoRaWAN is fantastic if you're sending small amounts of data. And if you're taking and fragmenting that data to send it multiple times, if you transmit large amounts of data with LoRa, you'll end up consuming more battery because you're sending a longer data stream.
Yeah, absolutely. Just coming to add to that, it's the same as Chris was mentioning a minute or two ago about seeing the lots of condition monitoring sensors. Right. But they're not actually using LoRaWAN, they're using BLE. And the reason they're using BLE is, as you said, Chris, they're vibration sensors, just by their nature, if they're sampling at 20 kilohertz and things like that, they're huge amounts of data that they need to get off. And LoRaWAN is not the best connectivity to do that, even though you might need less gateways. Yeah. Yep. You destroy the battery life, if you like, if you try to do it with that. And that's why BLE has come in and been adopted by the majority of the vendors that are making these condition monitoring sensors.
But to that point, you end up with a BLE to Ethernet gateway, which means you have an Ethernet wired infrastructure that you have to support, or you have a BLE to Wi-Fi infrastructure. And now you have a Wi-Fi to Ethernet. I mean, it's a hybrid of these technologies to ultimately deliver what that solution is going to look like and create the performance aspects, right? And like I said before, electricity, you know, being in areas, being able to run an Ethernet infrastructure. I mean, most of these infrastructures have been around in some cases 100 years. They weren't designed to support some of this equipment and some of these requirements.
No, your brownfield sites, the existing sites, is totally different than the greenfield, the new builds, where you can put in your fiber ring and things like that.
It's all part of the construction in order to make it cost effective. So what you might be doing at one of the brand new units, right, as I mentioned earlier, let's say a liquefied natural gas, they put into the infrastructure, there's fiber, there's electricity, there's the pods, there's all of that's predetermined, pre-laid out and part of the construction, right? Special enclosures and everything. Then they take and go to retrofit the old facility and none of that exists. And that's a high cost, right? So those are items that come into the design, they come into the opportunity, and then you look at that hybrid technology. Which parts can I use to support which parts that are deliverable to the business? So it's amazing. But it has, to Chris's point, it's grown in the last couple of years dramatically. The tools that we have available to us, the combination of devices, the LoRaWAN gateways that have the BLE sensors, the ultra wideband that utilizes the LTE. I mean, there's all this mix, but knowing when and where and what it costs to deploy, the trade-offs, the values, et cetera. That's the key to picking this technology.
And James, you touched on there quite nicely about cost planning and ROI, and that leads on to this question around wireless networks in hazardous areas typically being an order of magnitude higher than installations in safe areas. So what should be considered to reduce the overall cost for hazardous area deployment specifically?
And what the end goal is, right? What that expected delivery is. How can I use putting devices in a safe area? Can I leverage areas that may be safe within the facility? Areas that have different sets of rules, things of that nature. Can I lower the type of equipment, right? Can I use a LoRa to get the messaging across instead of having to deploy traditional Wi-Fi? Those are things that you have to look at. Again, it comes down to, you know, I'm known for my analogies, right? If you want to have a car that can do 250 miles an hour, you're going to have to change the oil every other month, right? There's no free lunch. So it all has to be accounted for to what the business needs are. If you can adjust the business needs to fit a lower cost profile, then that's a strategy that you should take. Leverage the equipment that's available, unless you're in an environment that doesn't allow for that. And you must deploy class 1 div 1, explosive enclosures, corrosive environments, those type of things. Some of that you can't avoid.
You can't. But I think a good one, perhaps, that is a really simple example that I've seen time and time again, and especially in the early days when Wi-Fi was first started to be deployed in process units and things like that, was there was no mesh backhauling that was reliable at the time that could perform at a similar level to an Ethernet cable, basically. Right. So, of course, if you've got to... There's not normally a problem of getting power on these facilities. There's normally a local equipment room, you know.
A light socket.
where you can get access to mains power or DC power relatively easily, in comparison to on these brownfield sites. Oh, I need to pick up an Ethernet, 100 meters away. Or, oh, I'll tell you what, we'll put fiber in instead and I can run that several hundred meters over to that other area where, and it's that part that becomes very expensive. If you've got to be running armored cable, armored Ethernet, or even fiber,
sealed
just
condo,
putting that in for each access point, that is an extremely costly thing to do. So the advent of the wireless mesh, the 5 gigahertz mesh, and now with the latest radios running at gigabits, that does really make it a lot lower cost. And I think that's why we've seen more and more Wi-Fi being deployed the last few years, as that wireless mesh technology is matured and gives near cable-like performance.
Point-to-point systems, wireless, they call it wireless fiber. That's a big part of what we've been involved with. Just to that point you mentioned, John, just about the cost of putting fiber in. So there's quite a few vendors that can supply you with a high bandwidth directional point-to-point radio link, some often offshore but often onshore as well.
We utilize stuff like that. I mean, that's the nice thing about the infrastructure, right? We do side-by-side, parallel, point-to-point, you know, narrow wave, you know, to get the most bandwidth to build these hotspots or these hub sites. You know, there's a huge amount of technology. But again, the one thing that I want to make sure to touch upon, and I know we talked about surveys and things like that, the biggest cost factor, right, the biggest cost avoidance, if you will, is having to come back after a deployment and doing it again, fixing all of those things that should have been caught in the initial survey, in the initial discovery, right? Picking that technology and knowing all of these aspects instead of looking at it and doing just a you know, pure predictive based on maps, which is very common, or a lightweight survey with one technology, because it's just so expensive to come back after you've missed the mark, after you've not delivered on the objective. Rarely do you get a second opportunity, right? So it's critical to be able to look at this list of devices that we have and then apply them appropriately for the facility and meeting those demands. I can't stress enough about that early on discovery.
Yeah, that's great. Oh, really big thank you to everyone for the insights on that particular point. And it seems like there certainly are a lot of really important aspects to planning a successful wireless network and in hazardous areas and in general for process industry environments. As we bring this episode to a close, James, I just want you to summarize maybe some of the key points or the key takeaways that shouldn't be forgotten for people and companies planning these wireless deployments.
I guess in summary, you know, the things to keep key points is don't be afraid of the initial sticker shock, right? It is going to be expensive. There's no way around it. Look at the finer points of what the value is to the business when it's said and done. What is the ROI? How long will it take to recover those upfront and investment costs? Focus on the pre-work. The pre-work is the key. Right. Without a good due diligence, business, you know, deliverables, expectations, interviews with the users and operators, the facility, learning those facilities. Don't look at two facilities the same. That has to be in the forefront. Right. Is that pre-work, preliminary work.
Well, I think that kind of rounds us up for today. Gentlemen, thank you so much for the input on the podcast. Thank you again, James, for joining us and providing your expertise. We hope you found the content of today's discussion useful. Please follow us on LinkedIn, where we'll be posting all of the latest podcast information and lots of other useful content for you to access. If you do have any questions off the back of today's podcast, then please do get in touch by emailing us at info@extronix.com, or you can visit our website, www.extronix.com, where you'll find all of our contact information. Thank you for listening, and please join us again for another edition of the Hazardous Area IoT podcast.